and they constitute everything. Look around you. It is all atoms. Not just the solid things like walls and tables and sofas, but the air in between. And they are there in numbers that you really cannot conceive. The basic working arrangement of atoms is the molecule, from the Latin for little mass. A molecule is simply two or more atoms working together in a more or less stable arrangement. Add two atoms of hydrogen to one of oxygen, and you have a molecule of water. Chemists tend to think in terms of molecules rather than elements, in much the way that writers tend to think in terms of words and not letters. So it is molecules they count, and these are numerous to say the least. At sea level, at a temperature of 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 1 cubic centimetre of air, that is, a space about the size of a sugar cube, will contain 45 billion billion molecules. And they are in every single cubic centimetre you see around you. Think how many cubic centimetres there are in the world outside your window. How many sugar cubes it would take to fill that view. Then think how many it would take to build a universe. Atoms, in short, are very abundant. They are also fantastically durable. Because they are so long-lived, atoms really get around. Every atom you possess has almost certainly passed through several stars and been part of millions of organisms on its way to becoming you. We are each so atomically numerous and so vigorously recycled at death that a significant number of our atoms, up to a billion for each of us, it has been suggested, probably once belonged to Shakespeare. A billion more each came from Buddha, and Genghis Khan, and Beethoven, and any other historical figure you care to name. The personages have to be historical, apparently, as it takes the atoms some decades to become thoroughly redistributed. However much you may wish it, you are not yet one with Elvis Presley. So we are all incarnations, though short-lived ones. When we die, our atoms will disassemble and move off to find new uses elsewhere, as part of a leaf or other human being, or drop of dew. Atoms, however, go on practically forever. Nobody actually knows how long an atom can survive, but according to Martin Rees, it is probably about 10^35 years, a number so big that even I am happy to express it in notation. Above all, atoms are tiny, very tiny indeed. 500,000 of them, lined up shoulder to shoulder, could hide behind a human hair. On such a scale, an individual atom is essentially impossible to imagine, but we can, of course, try. Start with a line the length of a millimetre. Now imagine that line divided into 1,000 equal widths. Each of those widths is a micron. This is the scale of microorganisms. A typical paramecium, for instance, is about 2 microns wide, 0.002 millimetres, which is really very small. If you wanted to see with your naked eye a paramecium swimming in a drop of water, you would have to enlarge the drop until it was some 40 feet across. However, if you wanted to see the atoms in the same drop, you would have to make the drop 15 miles across. Atoms, in other words, exist on a scale of minuteness of another order altogether. To get down to the scale of atoms, you would need to take each one of those micron slices and shave it into 10,000 finer widths. That's the scale of an atom. 1/10,000,000th of a millimetre. It is a degree of slenderness way beyond the capacity of our imaginations. But you can get some idea of the proportions if you bear in mind that one atom is to the width of a millimetre line as the thickness of a sheet of paper is to the height of the Empire State Building. It is, of course, the abundance and extreme durability of atoms that makes them so useful, and the tininess that makes them so hard to detect and understand. The realization that atoms are these three things, small, numerous, practically indestructible, and that all things are made from them, first occurred not to Antoine Laurent Lavoisier, as you might expect, or even to Henry Cavendish or Humphrey Davy, but rather to a spare and lightly educated English Quaker named John Dalton, whom we first encountered in the chapter on chemistry. Dalton was born in 1766 on the edge of the Lake District near Cockermouth to a family of poor but devout Quaker weavers. 4 years later, the poet William Wordsworth would also join the world at Cockermouth. He was an exceptionally bright student, so very bright indeed that at the improbably youthful age of 12 he was put in charge of the local Quaker school. This perhaps says as much about the school as about Dalton's precocity, but perhaps not. We know from his diaries that at about this time he was reading Newton's Principia in the original Latin, and other works of a similarly challenging nature. At 15, still schoolmastering, he took a job in the nearby town of Kendal, and a decade after that he moved to Manchester, scarcely stirring from there for the remaining 50 years of his life. In Manchester he became something of an intellectual whirlwind, producing books and papers on subjects ranging from meteorology to grammar. Colour blindness, a condition from which he suffered, was for a long time called Daltonism because of his studies. But it was a plump book called A New System of Chemical Philosophy, published in 1808, that established his reputation. There, in a short chapter of just 5 pages out of the book's more than 900, people of learning first encountered atoms in something approaching their modern conception. Dalton's simple insight was that at the root of all matter are exceedingly tiny, irreducible particles. We might as well attempt to introduce a new planet into the solar system, or annihilate one already in existence, as to create or destroy a particle of hydrogen, he wrote. Neither the idea of atoms nor the term itself was exactly new. Both had been developed by the ancient Greeks. Dalton's contribution was to consider the relative sizes and characters of these atoms and how they fit together. He knew, for instance, that hydrogen was the lightest element, so he gave it an atomic weight of 1. He believed also that water consisted of 7 parts of oxygen to 1 of hydrogen, and so he gave oxygen an atomic weight of 7. By such means was he able to arrive at the relative weights of the known elements. He wasn't always terribly accurate. Oxygen's atomic weight is actually 16, not 7, but the principle was sound and formed the basis for all of modern chemistry and much of the rest of modern science. The work made Dalton famous, albeit in a low-key English Quaker sort of way. In 1826, the French chemist P. J. Pelletier travelled to Manchester to meet the atomic hero. Pelletier expected to find him attached to some grand institution, so he was astounded to discover him teaching elementary arithmetic to boys in a small school on a back street. According to the scientific historian E. J. Holmyard, a confused Pelletier, upon beholding the great man, stammered, "Est-ce que j'ai l'honneur de m'adresser à Monsieur Dalton?" For he could hardly believe his eyes that this was the chemist of European fame, teaching a boy his first 4 rules. "Yes," said the matter-of-fact Quaker. "Wilt thou sit down whilst I put this lad right about his arithmetic?" Although Dalton tried to avoid all honours, he was elected to the Royal Society, against his wishes, showered with medals, and given a handsome government pension. When he died in 1844, 40,000 people viewed the coffin, and the funeral cortège stretched for 2 miles. His entry in the Dictionary of National Biography is one of the longest, rivalled in length only by those of Darwin and Lyell among 19th-century men of science. For a century after Dalton made his proposal, it remained entirely hypothetical, and a few eminent scientists, notably the Viennese physicist Ernst Mach, for whom is named the speed of sound, doubted the existence of atoms at all. "Atoms cannot be perceived by the senses. They are things of thought," he wrote. The existence of atoms was so doubtfully held in the German-speaking world in particular that it was said to have played a part in the suicide of the great theoretical physicist and atomic enthusiast Ludwig Boltzmann in 1906. It was Einstein who provided the first incontrovertible evidence of atoms' existence with his paper on Brownian motion in 1905. But this attracted little attention, and in any case Einstein was soon to become consumed with his work on general relativity. So the first real hero of the atomic age, if not the first personage on the scene, was Ernest Rutherford. Rutherford was born in 1871 in the back blocks of New Zealand to parents who had emigrated from Scotland to raise a little flax and a lot of children, to paraphrase Stephen Weinberg. Growing up in a remote part of a remote country, he was about as far from the mainstream of science as it was possible to be. But in 1895, he won a scholarship that took him to the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge University, which was about to become the hottest place in the world to do physics. Physicists are notoriously scornful of scientists from other fields. When the wife of the great Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli left him for a chemist, he was staggered with disbelief. "Had she taken a bullfighter, I would have understood," he remarked in wonder to a friend. "But a chemist!" It was a feeling Rutherford would have understood. "All science is either physics or stamp collecting," he once said, in a line that has been used many times since. There is a certain engaging irony, therefore, that when he won the Nobel Prize in 1908, it was in chemistry, not physics. Rutherford was a lucky man. Lucky to be a genius, but even luckier to live at a time when physics and chemistry were so exciting and so compatible, his own sentiments notwithstanding. Never again would they quite so comfortably overlap. For all his success, Rutherford was not an especially brilliant man, and was actually pretty terrible at mathematics. Often, during lectures, he would get so lost in his own equations that he would give up halfway through and tell the students to work it out for themselves. According to his long-time colleague, James Chadwick, discoverer of the neutron, he wasn't even particularly clever at experimentation. He was simply tenacious and open-minded. For brilliance, he substituted shrewdness and a kind of daring. His mind, in the words of one biographer, was always operating out toward the frontiers, as far as he could see, and that was a great deal further than most other men. Confronted with an intractable problem, he was prepared to work at it harder and longer than most people, and to be more receptive to unorthodox explanations. His greatest breakthrough came because he was prepared to spend immensely tedious hours sitting at a screen counting alpha particle scintillations, as they were known, the sort of work that would normally have been farmed out. He was one of the first to see, possibly the very first, that the power inherent in the atom could, if harnessed, make bombs powerful enough to make this old world vanish in smoke. Physically, he was big and booming, with a voice that made the timid shrink. Once, when told that Rutherford was about to make a radio broadcast across the Atlantic, a colleague dryly asked, "Why use radio?" He also had a huge amount of good-natured confidence. When someone remarked to him that he seemed always to be at the crest of a wave, he responded, "Well, after all, I made the wave, didn't I?" C.P. Snow recalled how once in a Cambridge tailor's he overheard Rutherford remark, "Every day I grow in girth, and in mentality." But both girth and fame were far ahead of him in 1895, when he fetched up at the Cavendish. The name comes from the same Cavendishes who produced Henry. This one was William Cavendish, 7th Duke of Devonshire, who was a gifted mathematician and steel baron in Victorian England. In 1870 he gave the university £6,300 to build an experimental lab. It was a singularly eventful period in science. In the year of his arrival in Cambridge, Wilhelm Röntgen discovered X-rays at the University of Würzburg in Germany, and the next year Henri Becquerel discovered radioactivity. And the Cavendish itself was about to embark on a long period of greatness. In 1897, J.J. Thomson and colleagues would discover the electron there. In 1911, C.T.R. Wilson would produce the first particle detector there, as we shall see, and in 1932, James Chadwick would discover the neutron there. Further still in the future, James Watson and Francis Crick would discover the structure of DNA at the Cavendish in 1953. In the beginning, Rutherford worked on radio waves, and with some distinction, he managed to transmit a crisp signal more than a mile, a very reasonable achievement for the time, but gave it up when he was persuaded by a senior colleague that radio had little future. On the whole, however, Rutherford didn't thrive at the Cavendish. After 3 years there, feeling he was going nowhere, he took a post at McGill University in Montreal, and there he began his long and steady rise to greatness. By the time he received his Nobel Prize for investigations into the disintegration of the elements and the chemistry of radioactive substances, according to the official citation, he had moved on to Manchester University. And it was there, in fact, that he would do his most important work in determining the structure and nature of the atom. By the early 20th century, it was known that atoms were made of parts. Thomson's discovery of the electron had established that. But it wasn't known how many parts there were, or how they fit together, or what shape they took. Some physicists thought that atoms might be cube-shaped, because cubes can be packed together so neatly without any wasted space. The more general view, however, was that an atom was more like a currant bun or a plum pudding, a dense, solid object that carried a positive charge, but that was studded with negatively charged electrons, like the currants in a currant bun. In 1910, Rutherford, assisted by his student Hans Geiger, who would later invent the radiation detector that bears his name, fired ionized helium atoms, or alpha particles, at a sheet of gold foil. Geiger would also later become a loyal Nazi, unhesitatingly betraying Jewish colleagues, including many who had helped him. To Rutherford's astonishment, some of the particles bounced back. It was as if, he said, he had fired a 15-inch shell at a sheet of paper, and it rebounded into his lap. This was just not supposed to happen. After considerable reflection, he realized there could be only one possible explanation. The particles that bounced back were striking something small and dense at the heart of the atom, while the other particles sailed through unimpeded. An atom, Rutherford realized, was mostly empty space, with a very dense nucleus at the center. This was a most gratifying discovery, but it presented one immediate problem. By all the laws of conventional physics, atoms shouldn't, therefore, exist. Let us pause for a moment and consider the structure of the atom as we know it now. Every atom is made from three kinds of elementary particles. Protons, which have a positive electrical charge, electrons, which have a negative electrical charge, and neutrons, which have no charge. Protons and neutrons are packed into the nucleus, while electrons spin around outside. The number of protons is what gives an atom its chemical identity. An atom with one proton is an atom of hydrogen, one with two protons is helium, with three protons is lithium, and so on up the scale. Each time you add a proton, you get a new element. Because the number of protons in an atom is always balanced by an equal number of electrons, you will sometimes see it written that it is the number of electrons that defines an element. It comes to the same thing. The way it was explained to me is that protons give an atom its identity, electrons its personality. Neutrons don't influence an atom's identity, but they do add to its mass. The number of neutrons is generally about the same as the number of protons, but they can vary up and down slightly. Add a neutron or two, and you get an isotope. The terms you hear in reference to dating techniques in archaeology refer to isotopes. Carbon-14, for instance, which is an atom of carbon with 6 protons and 8 neutrons, the 14 being the sum of the two. Neutrons and protons occupy the atom's nucleus. The nucleus of an atom is tiny, only 1/1,000,000th of a billionth of the full volume of the atom, but fantastically dense since it contains virtually all the atom's mass. As Cropper has put it, if an atom were expanded to the size of a cathedral, the nucleus would be only about the size of a fly, but a fly many thousands of times heavier than the cathedral. It was this spaciousness, this resounding, unexpected roominess, that had Rutherford scratching his head in 1910. It is still a fairly astounding notion to consider that atoms are mostly empty space, and that the solidity we experience all around us is an illusion. When two objects come together in the real world, billiard balls are most often used for illustration, they don't actually strike each other. Rather, as Timothy Ferris explains, the negatively charged fields of the two balls repel each other. Were it not for their electrical charges, they could, like galaxies, pass right through each other unscathed. When you sit in a chair, you are not actually sitting there, but levitating above it at a height of 1 angstrom, 1/100,000,000th of a centimetre. Your electrons and its electrons implacably opposed to any closer intimacy. The picture that nearly everybody has in mind of an atom is of an electron or two flying around a nucleus, like planets orbiting a sun. This image was created in 1904, based on little more than clever guesswork, by a Japanese physicist named Hantaro Nagaoka. It is completely wrong, but durable just the same. As Isaac Asimov liked to note, it inspired generations of science fiction writers to create stories of worlds within worlds, in which atoms become tiny inhabited solar systems, or our solar system turns out to be merely a mote in some much larger scheme. Even now, CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, uses Nagaoka's image as a logo on its website. In fact, as physicists were soon to realize, electrons are not like orbiting planets at all, but more like the blades of a spinning fan, managing to fill every bit of space in their orbits simultaneously. But with the crucial difference that the blades of a fan only seem to be everywhere at once, electrons are. Needless to say, very little of this was understood in 1910, or for many years afterward. Rutherford's finding presented some large and immediate problems, not least that no electron should be able to orbit a nucleus without crashing. Conventional electrodynamic theory demanded that a flying electron should very quickly run out of energy, in only an instant or so, and spiral into the nucleus, with disastrous consequences for both. There was also the problem of how protons, with their positive charges, could bundle together inside the nucleus without blowing themselves and the rest of the atom apart. Clearly, whatever was going on down there in the world of the very small was not governed by the laws that applied in the macro world, where our expectations reside. As physicists began to delve into this subatomic realm, they realized that it wasn't merely different from anything we knew, but different from anything ever imagined. Because atomic behavior is so unlike ordinary experience, Richard Feynman once observed, it is very difficult to get used to, and it appears peculiar and mysterious to everyone, both to the novice and to the experienced physicist. When Feynman made that comment, physicists had had half a century to adjust to the strangeness of atomic behavior, so think how it must have felt to Rutherford and his colleagues in the early 1910s, when it was all brand new. One of the people working with Rutherford was a mild and affable young Dane named Niels Bohr. In 1913, while puzzling over the structure of the atom, Bohr had an idea so exciting that he postponed his honeymoon to write what became a landmark paper. Because physicists couldn't see anything so small as an atom, they had to try to work out its structure from how it behaved when they did things to it, as Rutherford had done by firing alpha particles at foil. Sometimes, not surprisingly, the results of these experiments were puzzling. One puzzle that had been around for a long time had to do with spectrum readings of the wavelengths of hydrogen. These produced patterns showing that hydrogen atoms emitted energy at certain wavelengths but not others. It was rather as if someone under surveillance kept turning up at particular locations but was never observed travelling between them. No one could understand why this should be. It was while puzzling over this problem that Bohr was struck by a solution and dashed off his famous paper, called On the Constitutions of Atoms and Molecules. The paper explained how electrons could keep from falling into the nucleus by suggesting that they could occupy only certain well-defined orbits. According to the new theory, an electron moving between orbits would disappear from one and reappear instantaneously in another without visiting the space between. This idea, the famous quantum leap, is of course utterly strange. But it was too good not to be true. It not only kept electrons from spiraling catastrophically into the nucleus, it also explained hydrogen's bewildering wavelengths. The electrons only appeared in certain orbits because they only existed in certain orbits. It was a dazzling insight, and it won Bohr the 1922 Nobel Prize in Physics, the year after Einstein received his. Meanwhile, the tireless Rutherford, now back at Cambridge as J.J. Thomson's successor as head of the Cavendish Laboratory, came up with a model that explained why the nuclei didn't blow up. He saw that they must be offset by some type of neutralizing particles, which he called neutrons. The idea was simple and appealing, but not easy to prove. Rutherford's associate, James Chadwick, devoted 11 intense years to hunting for neutrons before finally succeeding in 1932. He, too, was awarded with a Nobel Prize in Physics in 1935. As Morse and his colleagues point out in their history of the subject, the delay in discovery was probably a very good thing, as mastery of the neutron was essential to the development of the atomic bomb. Because neutrons have no charge, they aren't repelled by the electrical fields at the heart of an atom, and thus could be fired like tiny torpedoes into an atomic nucleus, setting off the destructive process known as fission. Had the neutron been isolated in the 1920s, they note, it is very likely the atomic bomb would have been developed first in Europe, undoubtedly by the Germans. As it was, the Europeans had their hands full trying to understand the strange behavior of the electron. The principal problem they faced was that the electron sometimes behaved like a particle and sometimes like a wave. This impossible duality drove physicists nearly mad. For the next decade, all across Europe, they furiously thought and scribbled and offered competing hypotheses. In France, Prince Louis-Victor de Broglie, the scion of a ducal family, found that certain anomalies in the behavior of electrons disappeared when one regarded them as waves. The observation excited the attention of the Austrian Erwin Schrödinger, who made some deft refinements and devised a handy system called wave mechanics. At almost the same time, the German physicist Werner Heisenberg came up with a competing theory called matrix mechanics. This was so mathematically complex that hardly anyone really understood it, including Heisenberg himself. "I do not even know what a matrix is," Heisenberg despaired to a friend at one point. But it did seem to solve certain problems that Schrödinger's waves failed to explain. The upshot is that physics had two theories, based on conflicting premises, that produced the same results. It was an impossible situation. Finally, in 1926, Heisenberg came up with a celebrated compromise, producing a new discipline that came to be known as quantum mechanics. At the heart of it was Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which states that the electron is a particle, but a particle that can be described in terms of waves. The uncertainty around which the theory is built is that we can know the path an electron takes as it moves through a space, or we can know where it is at a given instant, but we cannot know both. Any attempt to measure one will unavoidably disturb the other. This isn't a matter of simply needing more precise instruments. It is an immutable property of the universe. There is a little uncertainty about the use of the word uncertainty in regard to Heisenberg's principle. Michael Frayn, in an afterword to his play Copenhagen, notes that several words in German, Unsicherheit, Unschärfe, Unbestimmtheit, have been used by various translators, but that none quite equates to the English uncertainty. Frayn suggests that indeterminacy would be a better word for the principle, and indeterminability would be better still. What this means in practice is that you can never predict where an electron will be at any given moment. You can only list its probability of being there. In a sense, as Dennis Overby has put it, an electron doesn't exist until it is observed. Or, put slightly differently, until it is observed, an electron must be regarded as being at once everywhere and nowhere. If this seems confusing, you may take some comfort in knowing that it was confusing to physicists, too. Overby notes, Bohr once commented that a person who wasn't outraged on first hearing about quantum theory didn't understand what had been said. Heisenberg, when asked how one could envision an atom, replied, "Don't try." So the atom turned out to be quite unlike the image that most people had created. The electron doesn't fly around the nucleus like a planet around its sun, but instead takes on the more amorphous aspect of a cloud. The shell of an atom isn't some hard, shiny casing, as illustrations sometimes encourage us to suppose, but simply the outermost of these fuzzy electron clouds. The cloud itself is essentially just a zone of statistical probability, marking the area beyond which the electron only very seldom strays. Thus an atom, if you could see it, would look more like a very fuzzy tennis ball than a hard-edged metallic sphere. But not much like either, or indeed like anything you've ever seen. We are, after all, dealing here with a world very different from the one we see around us. It seemed as if there was no end of strangeness. For the first time, as James Treffel has put it, scientists had encountered an area of the universe that our brains just aren't wired to understand. Or, as Feynman expressed it, things on a small scale behave nothing like things on a large scale. As physicists delved deeper, they realized they had found a world where not only could electrons jump from one orbit to another without traveling across any intervening space, but matter could pop into existence from nothing at all. Provided, in the words of Alan Lightman of MIT, it disappears again with sufficient haste. Perhaps the most arresting of quantum improbabilities is the idea, arising from Wolfgang Pauli's exclusion principle of 1925, that the subatomic particles in certain pairs, even when separated by the most considerable distances, can each instantly know what the other is doing. Particles have a quality known as spin, and, according to quantum theory, the moment you determine the spin of one particle, its sister particle, no matter how distant away, will immediately begin spinning in the opposite direction at the same rate. It is as if, in the words of the science writer Lawrence Joseph, you had two identical pool balls, one in Ohio and the other in Fiji, and the instant you sent one spinning, the other would immediately spin in a contrary direction at precisely the same speed. Remarkably, the phenomenon was proved in 1997, when physicists at the University of Geneva sent photons 7 miles in opposite directions and demonstrated that interfering with one provoked an instantaneous response in the other. Things reached such a pitch that at one conference Bohr remarked of a new theory that the question was not whether it was crazy, but whether it was crazy enough. To illustrate the non-intuitive nature of the quantum world, Schrödinger offered a famous thought experiment in which a hypothetical cat was placed in a box with one atom of a radioactive substance attached to a vial of hydrocyanic acid. If the particle degraded within an hour, it would trigger a mechanism that would break the vial and poison the cat. If not, the cat would live. But we could not know which was the case, so there was no choice, scientifically, but to regard the cat as 100% alive and 100% dead at the same time. This means, as Stephen Hawking has observed, with a touch of understandable excitement, that one cannot predict future events exactly if one cannot even measure the present state of the universe precisely. Because of its oddities, many physicists disliked quantum theory, or at least certain aspects of it, and none more so than Einstein. This was more than a little ironic, since it was he, in his Annus Mirabilis of 1905, who had so persuasively explained how photons of light could sometimes behave like particles, and sometimes like waves, the notion at the very heart of the new physics. "Quantum theory is very worthy of regard," he observed politely, but he really didn't like it. "God doesn't play dice," he said. Or at least that is how it is nearly always rendered. The actual quote was, "It seems hard to sneak a look at God's cards, but that he plays dice and uses telepathic methods is something that I cannot believe for a single moment." Einstein couldn't bear the notion that God could create a universe in which some things were forever unknowable. Moreover, the idea of action at a distance, that one particle could instantaneously influence another trillions of miles away, was a stark violation of the special theory of relativity. This expressly decreed that nothing could outrace the speed of light. And yet here were physicists insisting that somehow, at the subatomic level, information could. No one, incidentally, has ever explained how the particles achieve this feat. Scientists have dealt with this problem, according to the physicist Yakir Akhranov, by not thinking about it. Above all, there was the problem that quantum physics introduced a level of untidiness that hadn't previously existed. Suddenly, you needed two sets of laws to explain the behavior of the universe: quantum theory for the world of the very small, and relativity for the larger universe beyond. The gravity of relativity theory was brilliant at explaining why planets orbited suns or why galaxies tended to cluster, but turned out to have no influence at all at the particle level. To explain what kept atoms together, other forces were needed, and in the 1930s, two were discovered: the strong nuclear force and weak nuclear force. The strong force binds atoms together. It's what allows protons to bed down together in the nucleus. The weak force engages in more miscellaneous tasks, mostly to do with controlling the rates of certain sorts of radioactive decay. The weak nuclear force, despite its name, is 10 billion 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 times stronger than gravity. And the strong nuclear force is more powerful still, vastly so in fact, but their influence extends to only the tiniest distances. The grip of the strong force reaches out only to about 1/100,000th of the diameter of an atom. That's why the nuclei of atoms are so compacted and dense, and why elements with big, crowded nuclei tend to be so unstable. The strong force just can't hold on to all the protons. The upshot of all this is that physics ended up with two bodies of laws, one for the world of the very small, one for the universe at large, leading quite separate lives. Einstein disliked that, too. He devoted the rest of his life to searching for a way to tie up these loose ends by finding a grand unified theory, and always failed. From time to time he thought he had it, but it always unraveled on him in the end. As time passed, he became increasingly marginalized and even a little pitied. Almost without exception, wrote Snow, his colleagues thought, and still think, that he wasted the second half of his life. Elsewhere, however, real progress was being made. By the mid-1940s, scientists had reached a point where they understood the atom at an extremely profound level, as they all too effectively demonstrated in August 1945, by exploding a pair of atomic bombs over Japan. By this point, physicists could be excused for thinking that they had just about conquered the atom. In fact, everything in particle physics was about to get a whole lot more complicated. But before we take up that slightly exhausting story, we must bring another straw of our history up to date by considering an important and salutary tale of avarice, deceit, bad science, several needless deaths, and the final determination of the age of the Earth. 10. Getting the lead out. In the late 1940s, a graduate student at the University of Chicago named Claire Patterson, who was, first name notwithstanding, an Iowa farm boy by origin, was using a new method of lead isotope measurement to try to get a definitive age for the Earth at last. Unfortunately, all his samples came up contaminated, usually wildly so. Most contained something like 200 times the levels of lead that would normally be expected to occur. Many years would pass before Patterson realized that the reason for this lay with a regrettable Ohio inventor named Thomas Midgley, Jr. Midgley was an engineer by training, and the world would no doubt have been a safer place if he had stayed so. Instead, he developed an interest in the industrial applications of chemistry. In 1921, while working for the General Motors Research Corporation in Dayton, Ohio, he investigated a compound called tetraethyl lead, also known confusingly as lead tetraethyl, and discovered that it significantly reduced the juddering condition known as engine knock. Even though lead was widely known to be dangerous, by the early years of the 20th century it could be found in all manner of consumer products. Food came in cans, sealed with lead solder. Water was often stored in lead-lined tanks. It was sprayed onto fruit as a pesticide in the form of lead arsenate. It even came as part of the packaging of toothpaste tubes. Hardly a product existed that didn't bring a little lead into consumers' lives. However, nothing gave it a greater and more lasting intimacy than its addition to gasoline. Lead is a neurotoxin. Get too much of it, and you can irreparably damage the brain and central nervous system. Among the many symptoms associated with overexposure are blindness, insomnia, kidney failure, hearing loss, cancer, palsies, and convulsions. In its most acute form, it produces abrupt and terrifying hallucinations, disturbing to victims and onlookers alike, which generally then give way to coma and death. You really don't want to get too much lead into your system. On the other hand, lead was easy to extract and work, and almost embarrassingly profitable to produce industrially. And tetraethyl lead did indubitably stop engines from knocking. So in 1923, three of America's largest corporations, General Motors, DuPont, and Standard Oil of New Jersey, formed a joint enterprise called the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation, later shortened to simply Ethyl Corporation, with a view to making as much tetraethyl lead as the world was willing to buy. And that proved to be a very great deal. They called their additive ethyl, or ethyl, because it sounded friendlier and less toxic than lead, and introduced it for public consumption, in more ways than most people realized, on February 1, 1923. Almost at once, production workers began to exhibit the staggered gait and confused faculties that mark the recently poisoned. Also, almost at once, the Ethyl Corporation embarked on a policy of calm but unyielding denial that would serve it well for decades. As Sharon Birch McGrain notes in her absorbing history of industrial chemistry, Prometheans in the Lab, when employees at one plant developed irreversible delusions, a spokesman blandly informed reporters, "These men probably went insane because they worked too hard." Altogether, at least 15 workers died in the early days of production of leaded gasoline, and untold numbers of others became ill, often violently so. The exact numbers are unknown because the company nearly always managed to hush up news of embarrassing leakages, spills, and poisonings. At times, however, suppressing the news became impossible, most notably in 1924, when, in a matter of days, 5 production workers died and 35 more were turned into permanent staggering wrecks at a single ill-ventilated facility. As rumors circulated about the dangers of the new product, Ethyl's ebullient inventor, Thomas Midgley, decided to hold a demonstration for reporters to allay their concerns. As he chatted away about the company's commitment to safety, he poured tetraethyl lead over his hands, then held a beaker of it to his nose for 60 seconds, claiming all the while that he could repeat the procedure daily without harm. In fact, Midgley knew only too well the perils of lead poisoning. He had himself been made seriously ill from overexposure a few months earlier, and now, except when reassuring journalists, never went near the stuff if he could help it. Buoyed by the success of leaded gasoline, Midgley now turned to another technological problem of the age. Refrigerators in the 1920s were often appallingly risky because they used dangerous gases that sometimes leaked. One leak from a refrigerator at a hospital in Cleveland, Ohio in 1929 killed more than 100 people. Midgley set out to create a gas that was stable, non-flammable, non-corrosive, and safe to breathe. With an instinct for the regrettable that was almost uncanny, he invented chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. Seldom has an industrial product been more swiftly or unfortunately embraced. CFCs went into production in the early 1930s and found 1,000 applications in everything from car air conditioners to deodorant sprays, before it was noticed, half a century later, that they were devouring the ozone in the stratosphere. As you will be aware, this was not a good thing. Ozone is a form of oxygen in which each molecule bears 3 atoms of oxygen instead of 2. It is a bit of a chemical oddity in that at ground level it is a pollutant, while way up in the stratosphere it is beneficial, since it soaks up dangerous ultraviolet radiation. Beneficial ozone is not terribly abundant, however. If it were distributed evenly throughout the stratosphere, it would form a layer just 1/8 of an inch or so thick. That is why it is so easily disturbed, and why such disturbances don't take long to become critical. Chlorofluorocarbons are also not very abundant. They constitute only about 1 part per billion of the atmosphere as a whole, but they are extravagantly destructive. 1 pound of CFCs can capture and annihilate 70,000 pounds of atmospheric ozone. CFCs also hang around for a long time, about a century on average, wreaking havoc all the while. They are also great heat sponges. A single CFC molecule is about 10,000 times more efficient at exacerbating greenhouse effects than a molecule of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is, of course, no slouch itself as a greenhouse gas. In short, chlorofluorocarbons may ultimately prove to be just about the worst invention of the 20th century. Midgley never knew this, because he died long before anyone realized how destructive CFCs were. His death was itself memorably unusual. After becoming crippled with polio, Midgley invented a contraption involving a series of motorized pulleys that automatically raised or turned him in bed. In 1944, he became entangled in the cords as the machine went into action, and was strangled. If you were interested in finding out the ages of things, the University of Chicago in the 1940s was the place to be. Willard Libby was in the process of inventing radiocarbon dating, allowing scientists to get an accurate reading of the age of bones and other organic remains, something they had never been able to do before. Up to this time, the oldest reliable dates went back no further than the first dynasty in Egypt, from about 3000 BC. No one could confidently say, for instance, when the last ice sheets had retreated, or at what time in the past the Cro-Magnon people had decorated the caves of Lascaux in France. Libby's idea was so useful that he would be awarded a Nobel Prize for it in 1960. It was based on the realization that all living things have within them an isotope of carbon called carbon-14, which begins to decay at a measurable rate the instant they die. Carbon-14 has a half-life, that is, the time it takes for half of any sample to disappear, of about 5,600 years. So by working out how much a given sample of carbon had decayed, Libby could get a good fix on the age of an object, though only up to a point. After 8 half-lives, only 1/256th of the original radioactive carbon remains, which is too little to make a reliable measurement. So radiocarbon dating works only for objects up to 40,000 or so years old. If you ever wondered how the atoms determine which 50% will die and which 50% will survive for the next session, the answer is that the half-life is really just a statistical convenience, a kind of actuarial table for elemental things. Imagine you had a sample of material with a half-life of 30 seconds. It isn't that every atom in the sample will exist for exactly 30 seconds, or 60 seconds, or 90 seconds, or some other tidily ordained period. Each atom will, in fact, survive for an entirely random length of time that has nothing to do with multiples of 30. It might last until 2 seconds from now, or it might oscillate away for years, or decades, or centuries to come. No one can say. But what we can say is that for the sample as a whole, the rate of disappearance will be such that half the atoms will disappear every 30 seconds. It's an average rate, in other words, and you can apply it to any large sampling. Someone once worked out, for instance, that dimes have a half-life of about 30 years. Curiously, just as the technique was becoming widespread, certain flaws within it became apparent. To begin with, it was discovered that one of the basic components of Libby's formula, known as the decay constant, was off by about 3%. By this time, however, thousands of measurements had been taken throughout the world. Rather than restate every one, scientists decided to keep the inaccurate constant. Thus, Tim Flannery notes, every raw radiocarbon date you read today is given as too young by around 3%. The problems didn't quite stop there. It was also quickly discovered that carbon-14 samples can be easily contaminated with carbon from other sources. A tiny scrap of vegetable matter, for instance, that has been collected with a sample and not noticed. For younger samples, those under 20,000 years or so, slight contamination does not always matter so much, but for older samples it can be a serious problem, because so few remaining atoms are being counted. In the first instance, to borrow from Flannery, it is like miscounting by a dollar when counting to 1,000. In the second, it is more like miscounting by a dollar when you have only $2 to count. Libby's method was also based on the assumption that the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere and the rate at which it has been absorbed by living things has been consistent throughout history. In fact, it hasn't been. We now know that the volume of atmospheric carbon-14 varies depending on how well or not Earth's magnetism is deflecting cosmic rays, and that that can vary significantly over time. This means that some carbon-14 dates are more dubious than others. This is particularly so with dates just around the time that people first came to the Americas, which is one of the reasons the matter is so perennially in dispute. Finally, and perhaps a little unexpectedly, readings can be thrown out by seemingly unrelated external factors, such as the diets of those whose bones are being tested. One recent case involved the long-running debate over whether syphilis originated in the New World or the Old. Archaeologists in Hull, in the north of England, found that monks in a monastery graveyard had suffered from syphilis, but the initial conclusion that the monks had done so before Columbus's voyage was cast into doubt by the realization that they had eaten a lot of fish, which could make their bones appear to be older than in fact they were. The monks may well have had syphilis, but how it got to them and when remained tantalizingly unresolved. Because of the accumulated shortcomings of carbon-14, scientists devised other methods of dating ancient materials, among them thermoluminescence, which measures electrons trapped in clays, and electron spin resonance, which involves bombarding a sample with electromagnetic waves and measuring the vibrations of the electrons. But even the best of these could not date anything older than about 200,000 years, and they couldn't date inorganic materials like rocks at all, which is, of course, what you need if you wish to determine the age of your planet. The problems of dating rocks were such that at one point almost everyone in the world had given up on them. Had it not been for a determined English professor named Arthur Holmes, the quest might well have fallen into abeyance altogether. Holmes was heroic as much for the obstacles he overcame as for the results he achieved. By the 1920s, when Holmes was in the prime of his career, geology had slipped out of fashion. Physics was the new excitement of the age, and had become severely underfunded, particularly in Britain, its spiritual birthplace. At Durham University, Holmes was for many years the entire geology department. Often he had to borrow or patch together equipment in order to pursue his radiometric dating of rocks. At one point, his calculations were effectively held up for a year while he waited for the university to provide him with a simple adding machine. Occasionally, he had to drop out of academic life altogether to earn enough to support his family. For a time, he ran a curio shop in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, and sometimes he could not even afford the £5 annual membership fee for the Geological Society. The technique Holmes used in his work was theoretically straightforward and arose directly from the process first observed by Ernest Rutherford in 1904, in which some atoms decay from one element into another at a rate predictable enough that you can use them as clocks. If you know how long it takes for potassium-40 to become argon-40, and you measure the amounts of each in a sample, you can work out how old a material is. Holmes's contribution was to measure the decay rate of uranium into lead to calculate the age of rocks, and thus, he hoped, of the earth. But there were many technical difficulties to overcome. Holmes also needed, or at least would very much have appreciated, sophisticated gadgetry of a sort that could make very fine measurements from tiny samples, and as we have seen, it was all he could do to get a simple adding machine. So it was quite an achievement when in 1946 he was able to announce, with some confidence, that the Earth was at least 3 billion years old, and possibly rather more. Unfortunately, he now met yet another formidable impediment to acceptance, the conservativeness of his fellow scientists. Although happy to praise his methodology, many maintained that he had found not the age of the Earth, but merely the age of the materials from which the Earth had been formed. It was just at this time that Harrison Brown of the University of Chicago developed a new method for counting lead isotopes in igneous rocks, which is to say those that were created through heating as opposed to the laying down of sediments. Realizing that the work would be exceedingly tedious, he assigned it to young Claire Patterson as his dissertation project. Famously, he promised Patterson that determining the age of the Earth with his new method would be duck soup. In fact, it would take years. Patterson began work on the project in 1948. Compared with Thomas Midgley's colourful contributions to the March of Progress, Patterson's discovery of the age of the Earth feels more than a touch anticlimactic. For 7 years, first at the University of Chicago and then at the California Institute of Technology, where he moved in 1952, he worked in a sterile lab, making the very precise measurements of the lead-uranium ratios in carefully selected samples of old rock. The problem with measuring the age of the earth was that you needed rocks that were extremely ancient, containing lead and uranium-bearing crystals that were about as old as the planet itself. Anything much younger would obviously give you misleadingly youthful dates, but really ancient rocks are only rarely found on Earth. In the late 1940s, no one altogether understood why this should be. Indeed, and rather extraordinarily, we would be well into the Space Age before anyone could plausibly account for where all the Earth's old rocks went. The answer was plate tectonics, which we shall of course get to. Patterson, meantime, was left to try to make sense of things with very limited materials. Eventually, and ingeniously, it occurred to him that he could circumvent the rock shortage by using rocks from beyond Earth. He turned to meteorites. The assumption he made, rather a large one, but correct as it turned out, was that many meteorites are essentially leftover building materials from the early days of the solar system, and thus have managed to preserve a more or less pristine interior chemistry. Measure the age of these wandering rocks, and you would have the age also, near enough, of the Earth. As always, however, nothing was quite as straightforward as such a breezy description makes it sound. Meteorites are not abundant, and meteoritic samples not specially easy to get hold of. Moreover, Brown's measurement technique proved finicky in the extreme, and needed much refinement. Above all, there was the problem that Patterson's samples were continuously and unaccountably contaminated with large doses of atmospheric lead whenever they were exposed to air. It was this that eventually led him to create a sterile laboratory, the world's first, according to at least one account. It took Patterson 7 years of patient work just to assemble suitable samples for final testing. In the spring of 1953, he travelled to the Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois, where he was granted time on a late-model mass spectrograph, a machine capable of detecting and measuring the minute quantities of uranium and lead locked up in ancient crystals. When at last he had his results, Patterson was so excited that he drove straight to his boyhood home in Iowa and had his mother check him into a hospital because he thought he was having a heart attack. Soon afterward, at a meeting in Wisconsin, Patterson announced a definitive age for the Earth of 4,550 million years, plus or minus 70 million years, a figure that stands unchanged 50 years later, as McGrane admiringly notes. After 200 years of trying, the Earth finally had an age. His main work done, Patterson now turned his attention to the nagging question of all that lead in the atmosphere. He was astounded to find that what little was known about the effects of lead on humans was almost invariably wrong or misleading, and not surprisingly, he discovered, since for 40 years every study of lead's effects had been funded exclusively by manufacturers of lead additives. In one such study, a doctor who had no specialized training in chemical pathology undertook a 5-year program in which volunteers were asked to breathe in or swallow lead in elevated quantities. Then their urine and feces were tested. Unfortunately, as the doctor appears not to have known, lead is not excreted as a waste product. Rather, it accumulates in the bones and blood. That's what makes it so dangerous, and neither bone nor blood was tested. In consequence, lead was given a clean bill of health. Patterson quickly established that we had a lot of lead in the atmosphere. Still do, in fact, since lead never goes away, and that about 90% of it appeared to come from automobile exhaust pipes. But he couldn't prove it. What he needed was a way to compare lead levels in the atmosphere now with the levels that existed before 1923, when tetraethyl lead was introduced. It occurred to him that ice cores could provide the answer. It was known that snowfall in places like Greenland accumulates into discrete annual layers, because seasonal temperature differences produce slight changes in coloration from winter to summer. By counting back through these layers and measuring the amount of lead in each, he could work out global lead concentrations at any time for hundreds or even thousands of years. The notion became the foundation of ice core studies, on which much modern climatological work is based. What Patterson found was that before 1923 there was almost no lead in the atmosphere, and that since that time its level had climbed steadily and dangerously. He now made it his life's quest to get lead taken out of gasoline. To that end, he became a constant and often vocal critic of the lead industry and its interests. It would prove to be a hellish campaign. Ethar was a powerful global corporation with many friends in high places. Among its directors have been Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell and Gilbert Grosvenor of the National Geographic Society. Patterson suddenly found research funding withdrawn, or difficult to acquire. The American Petroleum Institute cancelled a research contract with him, as did the United States Public Health Service, a supposedly neutral government institution.